This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. Bringing home a baby can be a cause for celebration, but many mothers exit the hospital completely unaware of the risks they may face after delivery. A new CDC Foundation report shows that more than half of maternal deaths occur after the baby's born. Yet postpartum care often lacks formal support, leaving new mothers ill-equipped to identify warning signs and unlikely to get adequate attention if there is cause for concern. Recent reporting from NPR and ProPublica has put more attention on maternal mortality and postpartum health. Postpartum depression even came up in a recent episode of the ABC sitcom Black-ish.
You know what might be fun?
What?
If we take this postpartum depression quiz together?
Trey, I don't want to do that. I'm okay.
Totally. Totally. But I think we should take it just in case one of us has a debilitating mood disorder. Okay? So I'll go first. Do you feel sad, hopeless, overwhelmed, empty? That's a nope for me. How about you?
I feel sad.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel hopeless and I feel overwhelmed, but I don't feel empty, so I guess it's a no for me.
Okay. This is fun.
Yep.
All right, number two. Are you crying more often than usual? I'm just going to put a yes for you.
Dre, I'm fine. Okay, it's just the baby came early. And he's not sleeping. And he's not eating. I think he might be cursed.
That takes us down to question 17. Do you think your baby is cursed? Yes.
That's Anthony Anderson and Tracy Ellis Ross from Black-ish. There is hope for reframing the conversation about the health of new mothers and redesigning postpartum care, and that is what we will focus on as we close out our special series, Beyond Mother's Day. Now, fair warning, we will be talking about traumatic postpartum experiences. You might find it a little upsetting, especially if it triggers a memory for you. But we're also going to talk about what can be done to help support postpartum mothers. Joining us from NPR in New York is Deborah Bingham, a registered nurse. She's the founder and executive director of the Institute for Perinatal Quality Improvement and an associate professor at the University of Maryland School of Nursing. Her research was featured in the NPR and ProPublica reports about maternal health. Deborah, welcome to 1A.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Joining us from UNC Chapel Hill is Sarah Verbeest, the executive director of the Center for Maternal and Infant Health at the UNC School of Medicine. She's also the director of the Jordan Institute for Families at the UNC School of Social Work. Sarah, welcome.
Thank you.
And joining us from Barcelona is Lynn McIntyre, the coordinator for Postpartum Support International. Lynn, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Joshua.
Deborah Bingham, let me start with you and go back to that clip from Black-ish for a moment, where we hear Dre and Rainbow taking the postpartum quiz together. Why would a mother like her need a quiz to determine her mental health post-delivery? What do you see as being at the heart of this issue surrounding postpartum care?
Well, first, I was impressed that they even had the quiz and thought to do that, because too often they're not even aware that that's even an option. So sometimes we're just not as in touch with what's wrong and what to do about it, and even recognizing the problem.
And I do kind of love the fact that he threw in the question about the cursed baby. I'm guessing that's not on the real quiz. But we did get a number of voicemails from listeners about their experiences during the postpartum period. Here is what one listener left in our inbox.
My name is Jamie, calling from New Hampshire. I recently had twin boys and very shortly after birth fell into a severe depression. It was so confusing to be feeling this way right after I had what should be the most beautiful experience of my life. All I felt was sadness, fear, hopelessness, and an enormous amount of guilt and shame for feeling this way. Society would have us believe that mothers instantly fall in love with their newborns, and new motherhood is just sunshine and rainbows. But the reality is the first few months can be excruciatingly hard. I sought treatment and medication in order to start feeling better, and I'm still working on crawling out of the darkness. I love my boys very much and take care of them fully, but their arrival brought about challenges and emotions that I never could have anticipated.
Jamie, I'm glad you shared your story with us. Thank you so much. Sarah Verbeest, what about that? Talk about the medical and cultural nature of this problem.
Absolutely. I am so excited about this series as a longtime advocate for new moms. I think that
Something that's really important is that we speak truth to postpartum health. And in particular, I'd just like to rattle off a bit of a list of what is normal for a postpartum woman to experience. So she can have incontinence, and this can last for just a little bit of time. It can last for a long time. She can have muscle aches in places that she didn't know existed. There's still pain. On TV, it looks like you have a baby and you just feel great. But in reality, women have pain from C-sections, from sore bottoms and sore breasts, and that can last for months. We know that the bellies that looked all strong and taut when you're pregnant become mushy, so our bodies look different. We get worried about waist loss. There's exhaustion, pure and complete exhaustion. We have crazy hormone shifts that can trigger really scary feelings. We are really worried about keeping this little person alive. We hear people talk to us about birth control, but no one wants to talk about how we might feel about sex and relationships. Our brains can feel fuzzy. We can be worried about money. We can be dealing with complicated family dynamics. And we can have a sense of, who am I in this new role in my life? And so these are all the different things that women are dealing with, figuring out, who am I as a mom? How do I care for the rest of my family? And how do I take care of my physical self? And I think that when we forget that she's dealing with all of that, we lose a lot of opportunities to be helpful.
Yeah, and before I come to you, Lynn McIntyre, Sarah, I think one of the other things, and maybe you could speak to this better than I could, but I wonder how much just societal expectation factors into postpartum depression. I mean, Kate Middleton kind of stunned the world with this graceful exit from the hospital 10 hours after she gave birth to her third child. And we constantly see more pictures in magazines of celebrities who have these speedy post-weight delivery weight loss strategies. It seems like there is an increasingly demanding expectation on women after they've delivered their baby to suck it up, tighten up, and get right back to work.
Well, I would say that that's not something new. I think that that's been around for a long time, this expectation and pressure to be fine, to have it all together, and to model this competence. And I think that sometimes women to women, we also perpetuate that with each other by not being honest about this experience. And so I think that series like this are exactly what needs to happen so we can have the real conversations. And we can also remember that Princess Kate probably had an entire hair and makeup crew. She went home to nannies and nurses and probably a live-in physician. So her reality is not our reality.
Lynn McIntyre, let me come to you. You became an advocate after struggling with postpartum depression. How much of the stories we've heard so far rings true with your experience?
Oh, I would say almost everything. I mean, you know, not knowing what was ahead of me as a new mother, even though I had been around my older sisters when they had children, having absolutely no medical professionals or childbirth class teachers or anyone like that so much as mention the possibility of these illnesses, which are the number one complication of pregnancy, to facing, you know, checkout at Target when you've got 6,000 diapers and maybe something frozen to put in the microwave, and you've got the cover of Us magazine with the latest starlet who lost all her weight. So I really identify with all of it, to tell you the truth.
When did you know, Lynn, that something was wrong?
So, you know, it's a very different, there's a very different answer in retrospect, right, than if, because really, in retrospect, I recognize that as soon as my son was born and the cord was cut, within a couple of hours, I was not feeling like myself, and something was definitely wrong. Unfortunately, I had to suffer 4 months of confusion and anxiety and racing thoughts and insomnia until one night I thought about jumping off the roof of our apartment building.
Oh, my God.
And, you know, it's obviously very extreme, but I can say now from, you know, the decade I've been doing this work and working with hundreds of mothers, it's unfortunately not uncommon.
Lynn, I hate to hold you short on that note. Yeah. We have to pause in just a moment, but I want to continue with your story in just a minute. I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR.
Support for 1A and the following message come from American Express. These days, keeping up with everything in the news is hard, whether it's politics or pop culture. American Express believes it's always easier to stay ahead when there's someone behind you. Easier to focus on what matters, to follow what interests you, to explore, to discover. And with American Express, you don't have to go it alone because they have your back. Don't live life without it.
Hey everyone, I'm Robin Hilton with All Songs Considered, NPR's Music Discovery Podcast. When you're in school, sometimes a song can be your best friend. It gives you hope, help purges anxieties, or just lets you know you're not alone in the world. On this week's show, we play the songs that got you through school. Hear All Songs Considered in the NPR One app or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Alyssa wrote on our Facebook page, "When I went in for my 6-week postnatal checkup, I told my midwife I was feeling like things would be better off if I was gone. I didn't want to die, but no one cared much about how I was doing, and it seemed like my son was in better hands without me, so maybe I should just go away. I cried a lot. She shrugged at me and offered me some antidepressants. I struggled for 2.5 years with postpartum depression till I finally said the right combinations of words to my gynecologist, who heard me and helped me get treatment." Lynn McIntyre, before we move on, I wanted you to have a chance to finish up your story. It sounded like things had gotten incredibly dire to the point where you thought about jumping off a building.
I did, and I really echo the sentiments of the listener who just commented that I didn't want to die either, which sounds, you know, kind of strange. But what I really, what was going on in my very addled and ill brain was that I just needed to sleep, and I needed everything to stop. And I've heard that those same sentiments echoed by so many mothers since then, that suicidality in suicidal ideation in the postpartum is quite often just a function of needing a break, but you're so ill and so tired that you don't see any other way of getting that break.
Deborah Bingham, before we move on with our conversation, I don't want us to camp out too hard on depression with the postpartum period. Obviously, it's a significant risk factor after birth. But what other post-delivery health risks are there that mothers should be keeping an eye out for?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked. We put together a very simple using the acronym post-birth, recognizing that there are a lot of leading causes of maternal mortality. And as you said, most of them occur in the postpartum period. And our work, we realized that there wasn't a lot of education women were receiving before they were going home from the hospitals. And also, the information was a bit scattered. And if you've, as described, you're feeling exhausted and a bit overwhelmed, even in the best of circumstances, you know, we wanted to have information that would be very helpful to people. So, to families, to the women, to anyone who's supporting them. So the acronym post-birth does take in account the leading causes of maternal mortality. And by being aware of these warning signs, I've already heard very powerful and amazing stories of women seeking care, obtaining that care. So POST is the acronym, stands for those warning signs that are emergency, that call 911, you don't wait. And so P is for pain in the chest, O is for obstructed breathing or shortness of breath, S is for seizures, T is for thoughts of hurting yourself or others, or your baby. So those, you know, that's something we've already been talking about. And then birth spells out warning signs that are urgent. These are not to be ignored and call a doctor or go to the emergency room if a woman has these conditions.
Mm-hmm.
So B is for like bleeding, soaking through one pad an hour, or blood clots the size of an egg or larger. We found that people didn't know how much is bleeding too much. I mean, most women haven't had a baby, or you don't have a baby that often. Mm-hmm. So we were very specific. I is for incision that is not healing. R is for red or swollen leg that is painful or warm to touch. T is for temperature of 100.4 degrees or higher, and H is for a headache that does not get better even after taking medicine, or a bad headache with vision changes. We found that the nurses were hesitant to bring up these warning signs. They didn't want to scare women, was the main reason they hesitated even teaching about this. The other thing we wanted to say is because there could be other warning signs. These are the most common causes of maternal deaths or injuries postpartum. But if a woman just, we wanted them to trust their instincts. If they feel like something's wrong, they need to feel confident to speak up and not be shy about that. And also just to make sure if they go and get help, even a year within the year of having a baby, they should make sure anyone they go and seek help from knows that they had a baby within that year. Mm-hmm. That's really important because that could change how the care providers take care of them.
Before we keep going, let's hear from another listener who left a note in our inbox.
My name is Tara, and I'm calling from Caldwell, Idaho. My situation happened 3 weeks after I had my daughter. I had retained placenta and started hemorrhaging, which caused me to have an emergency DNC where I lost so much blood that I was very close to needing a transfusion. And the doctors that did the DNC thanked me several times, saying that if I hadn't come in when I did, the situation could have been a lot more dire. My advice to mothers is to demand good care. The nurses at my postpartum checkup were having me do a lot of the things to myself that they should have been doing to me, like massaging my stomach to get everything out. And I didn't know how to do it, but I didn't ask them to do it for me. After the situation, when I had my son a couple years later, I was very active in telling them exactly what I needed and knowing my body.
Kara, I'm really glad that you shared your story, and I'm glad you brought up demanding good care, because that dovetails right into another voice we wanted to bring in for the rest of this conversation. Joining us from KUVO Public Radio in Denver is Deirdre Johnson, the CEO and Executive Director of the Center for African American Health. Deirdre, welcome to 1A.
Thank you for having me.
You had a story featured in a New York Times Magazine article about black mothers and mortality. We've been speaking a fair amount this week about the intersection of race and maternal mortality. What kinds of obstacles have you had to overcome to get the kind of care and attention that you needed postpartum?
You know, it's interesting because these days my sons are 13 and 14, and so what I'm struck with is how much hasn't changed. I was very proactive. My mother's a nurse, so I was raised to be very proactive and take health care seriously. Had great prenatal care. And I'm in that small rubric of women who, I've been told, I was in my late 30s when I gave birth, African American, and my preeclampsia was actually postpartum. So actually, up until I gave birth, everybody was fine. Within 48 hours, I ended up in ICU. But there was a point of reaction where, speaking of what you just mentioned, I don't get headaches. I had the worst headache of my life. So I gave birth around, it was actually 11:11 that morning. By dinner time, I was back in the hospital, told them, you know, I'm not feeling well. I just gave birth. My blood pressure was high when they took it. I knew it was high. I was actually given the response of, but you know, you people are typically high, so you're still within range. Thank you. And part of my argument was, but I know my body. You know, before becoming a mom, I ran constantly. I knew what my level was. Went back home because no one really was listening. The next day, I remember my dad was coming to visit to see his new grandchild. The headache was getting worse. And it was so bad that he actually drove me to the hospital. They paid attention that time because of my blood pressure. It was like 290 over 180.
Wow.
I had brain swelling, kidney, on the verge of kidney failure, on the verge of liver failure. So I was basically dying in front of them. And so that window of opportunity where we didn't have to get to this point was one issue that never left me. The other issue was because it was postpartum, I don't really think everyone knew what they were looking at because my OB was non-responsive. The hospital was giving every test you could think of, but just kind of watching. Spinal taps, you name it. It wasn't until my father called a friend of his in California who was an OB who said, you know what, she's got postpartum eclampsia. They've got to get her on magnesium immediately before she has a stroke. And that's really what happened. It was that family advocacy, because at that point I was barely coherent. But having a family that just pushed and pushed and pushed because we were not being listened to. And, you know, if that was the end of the story, it would be one thing. Fast forward 13 months later, I was at a different hospital. I particularly went to one where I knew they were specialized at high-risk births.
Mm-hmm.
So everybody knew my condition, my new OB. I thought I was good to go. You know, I had everything in mind. Once again, great birth. I felt okay. My kiddo was fine. And I remember within 24 hours, I was at Toys R Us buying a stroller for two, and it hit me, that exact same feeling. And so this was surreal, because this time when I got to the hospital, my husband took me there immediately. I knew all the lingo. I knew, you know, I'm starting to get a vascular headache. You should probably test my urine because I'm probably dumping protein. These things are happening. Please look in my chart.
But you had to go through it to know what to tell them.
Right. But that didn't matter. Even though I was at a different hospital, I was still in the same system, and they would not pause and go look at the records that I was pleading for them to look at. And so I'm sitting here slowly fading. Also, the new OB I had chosen was completely kind of non-reactive. And so once again, it was family lobbying to get my doctor changed. And I ended up okay ultimately, but I was in the hospital for 2 weeks. But I was there for a good 4 days before they figured out, oh, yeah, everything she told us has actually been taking place.
Right. It sounds like what you were describing with the blood pressure and the organ issues is like textbook preeclampsia. Preeclampsia is high blood pressure and signs of damage to another organ system like the liver or the kidneys. And eclampsia happens when a woman with preeclampsia goes into a coma or a seizure. So it seems like a great deal of what you had was textbook. Deirdre, could I ask you about your organization? You focus on healthcare equity issues among African Americans in the Denver area. What are you seeing in terms of how women of color are dealt with in the postpartum days, weeks, months?
You know, it's interesting because it's a similar story as what you see throughout the rest of the country. And ironically, I recently had a discussion with our local health department about some of the things that have been happening. Overall, black women are 3 times more likely to die around with complications of postpartum maternal health. And I was listening earlier just with regard to the postpartum depression piece. Across all race and ethnicities, evidently 30%, at least in our state, 30% of deaths are related to suicide or overdoses. So you have not only this perfect storm of what's happening if you don't have sufficient care, but what also is being missed in community or by the hospital when it comes to taking care of that mother.
Oh, wait, I'm sorry. You're saying that 30% of maternal deaths postpartum are related to suicides and overdoses?
Yes.
Really? Wow. That's kind of horrifying.
That's what I said when I heard it from some colleagues of mine at the Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment.
Let me come to Lynn McIntyre for a minute. How do these statistics strike you from a larger national, international level? Is this unusual, or is this more common than we might think?
It's definitely more common than we might think. And in countries, there's a couple of countries, the UK and Australia, that have done maternal mortality surveys a while ago and found that suicide was one of the top three, if not the leading cause of death in that first year after having a baby. The thing about the states is that, you know, each state keeps its death records its own way, and it's not really indicated on a death certificate if the decedent was also the mother of a less than one-year-old baby. So we don't have those good statistics, and we've never had a big national review, but UNC actually had a great paper a couple of years ago that they had delved into the death records in some states around the country and found that we were the same. It was top three for sure, and we were looking at, I think, 20% to a third of deaths. And one thing we know about suicidal ideation and suicide attempts in the postpartum is that for reasons that we don't understand, postpartum women elect to use more lethal means when they make a suicide attempt. Usually, you know, men complete more suicides, but in the postpartum, women do things like buy guns and jump off of buildings, and we think that's what, you know, leads it to be such a high rate.
Sarah Verbeest, what do we see being done about this? Do you get any sense that medical practitioners, healthcare organizations are hip to this and are trying to counteract it? Or is this just not really being discussed enough?
Well, I think that we have obviously a lot of silent suffering, a lot of isolation, and a lot of providers not taking women seriously. So I think that this series is very helpful in waking up healthcare professionals, in elevating the need for advocacy for women for themselves and for their partners on behalf of the people that they love. But I also am really encouraged that the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology have just issued a series of recommendations about improved postpartum care, setting new expectations for that visit, for the services that women need, and for really calling for much more intention and investment in that postpartum visit. And that's a really encouraging sign.
Sarah, I wonder if we might talk a little bit more about that when we continue our conversation and shift gears to the solutions. Some of these stories are so harrowing and so heartbreaking, but you're right, there is an effort to try to improve the way that we treat women in the postpartum weeks and months. Stay close.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting your short list of candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
I'm Ophira Eisenberg. Join me on NPR's Ask Me Another as we challenge contestants and celebrities to nerdy word games, music parodies, and ponderful trivia. Find us every week on the NPR One app and wherever you listen to podcasts.
Deborah, I wonder, before we start talking about solutions, can you talk a little bit about some of the research that was featured in NPR and ProPublica's reporting, particularly about what nurses are doing wrong and what they don't know about how to care for women postpartum?
Well, that study that you're referencing that we did is part of this, helps identify a solution. One of the solutions is to help ensure that the health providers, RNs in this situation in particular, who are performing post-birth education, know the warning signs and also know the risk factors for maternal deaths and injuries. So we found that, unfortunately, many of the nurses didn't think that maternal mortality rates had increased. They also, many of them thought that the rates had gone down as many as 12%. So we also identified that they also realized that they're part of the solution. 95% of them surveyed agreed or strongly agreed that it was their responsibility to teach women about postpartum complications. So that's part of the good news. And also there's been for several years a big push by the American Academy of Pediatrics to have the pediatrician, when the mother comes in, be able to ask about depression or other warning signs. I would expand that to even be including the post-birth, making sure all of the women know those, that information. So work by national organizations that have come together at the Council on Patient Safety and Women's Healthcare have actually come up with a bundle of recommendations to and multiples of over 17 professional organizations have signed on to work on this issue of improving postpartum care. So it's nationally recognized to be a problem. And I really, A1, the Association of Women's Health Obstetric and Neonatal Nurses, supported the study that then was highlighted in August when we put those results out there.
Sarah Verbiest, you mentioned the new recommendations from the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists. That might get to the heart of a question from David, who emailed, isn't the whole pregnancy and birth experience, including the baby's and mother's health, what OBGYNs go to school for? How is it that what's being discussed on today's show is not on the radar of OBGYNs and hospital staff? Lynn McIntyre, I wonder if maybe you might chime in partly on David's question and just partly on the differences you see in how the U.S. compares to other countries in terms of postpartum care. What have you seen in your work with Postpartum Support International that might serve as a model for the U.S.?
Well, certainly the U.K.'s visiting nurses, which is very related to the recommendation that Sarah was referencing from ACOG, to have visits at home by a professional who's dedicated to seeing how the mom is doing. Of course, she's going to check on the baby as well. And I echo the sentiment about the pediatricians. They, I think, have been wonderful. And quite frankly, the AAP stepped up sooner and more strongly than ACOG did, in my experience, in terms of dealing with postpartum care issues, and they've recognized their responsibility. But to have a professional who goes into the home so that mom doesn't have to pack up baby, and so that the professional can see the environment in which, you know, mom and baby are living, and it's irreplaceable. And I do think, I mean, it's been my experience, not frankly in Spain where I live, but in other Western European countries, that of course they have national healthcare systems that are having financial difficulties, but that do allow them to offer these services that are not offered in the States.
Willix asked, what can fathers do to help the mother? Clearly there are issues with health systems and the way that they support mothers postpartum, but what about in the family itself? What about fathers helping mothers postpartum?
You know, I think fathers are super critical. At the end of the day, everything is local. Your social support, your access to health. And moms have so much on their plates, especially during this time. And what's so interesting is, you know, when you have that book, What to Expect When You're Expecting, when it comes to complications, there might be a blurb or two. So to have that individual who kind of has that second pair of eyes, because if you're used to spinning mini platters and just getting things done, you may not even notice that you're having some challenges or that you might be changing how you're going through your day-to-day. And so someone who is not only your partner but loves you and understands you, whether it's husband, whether it's grandma, whether it's someone at your church or your neighbor. And so one of the things we're looking at, it's one thing to expand awareness to make sure that everyone knows this is an urgent problem and something we have to come together as a community. But we're looking at how can we really be broad and create systems of supports so when something does happen for a mom, not only is it identified, but we can take her hand and help her find the connections and resources and care that she needs until she can get through this phase.
Sarah, I wonder if maybe we also should talk about what kind of support fathers might need. Maria wrote on our website, glad to be hearing much more discussion about postpartum depression in women. Hope to begin hearing a little bit more about postpartum depression in men. My postpartum period was extremely stressful, not just because I was learning to care for an infant, but also because I couldn't figure out why my husband became withdrawn, angry, overly focused on his job, and refused to help with the baby. Now he's a devoted, amazing dad, but to this day, he won't admit he was depressed. I'm terrified that having another child would end our marriage.
I think that's an excellent point. In our fourth trimester project, we talked with a lot of different moms, and a theme that came up over and over again was how important the partners were in their lives. And we often leave them out of the conversation. They have a lot of questions. They may not be getting answers. And so I think that bringing them in to offering suggestions about things that they can do to provide support, and also giving them a chance to understand that they are also very impacted by having a new baby in their life. They are probably also not sleeping very well. They are probably also not eating particularly well. They may be experiencing challenges about what is their own role as provider for the family. And that can be very stressful. We haven't talked a lot about the economic impact of having a baby, but right. It's pretty significant. And I think then also kind of understanding this relationship with their wife, who it's changed a little bit. In some cases, they may be closer. In other cases, it may be a little different than they expected.
Deborah, I wonder if you might talk about some of the strategies regarding the healthcare system that you've developed. Is there anything that we need to do in the healthcare systems, insurance systems, to improve postpartum care? Maybe one or two things that rise to the top of the list?
Well, one thing is kind of maybe a little not intuitive is reducing C-sections. We've had such a rise in C-sections that's led to a more of a crisis postpartum. There's big national efforts and state efforts to increase vaginal births. So I think that's important to help get out there to women that one of the challenges postpartum, why we're seeing more complications postpartum is because of the rise in cesarean births.
Lynn McIntyre is the coordinator for Postpartum Support International. Lynn, thanks for talking to us.
Thanks for having me.
Deirdre Johnson, the CEO and executive director of the Center for African American Health. Deirdre, thank you.
Thank you.
Sarah Verbeest of the Center for Maternal and Infant Health and the Jordan Institute for Families at UNC. Thank you, Sarah.
Keep covering this topic. Thank you.
We sure will. And Deborah Bingham, registered nurse and the founder and executive director of the Institute for Perinatal Quality Improvement. Thank you, Deborah.
Thank you.
I'm Joshua Johnson. Thanks for listening. This is 1A.